first English Mindway podcast episode. My name is Martina Weifenbach and I'm excited to be here with Jonathan Reynolds today. In this podcast, we discuss mindfulness, innovation, and new ways to work. The Mindway podcast is for leaders, visionaries, and everyone who wants to shape their workplaces mindfully. With our amazing guests, we touch upon the latest in science and discuss practical insights to help you to pack your toolbox to design a more mindful workplace. Usually, and some of you might already know this, we choose one word that guides our conversations. Jonathan's and my word today will be simplicity. Allow me to introduce Jonathan. Jonathan Reynolds is founder and CEO of Mindful Life, Mindful Work, and he is based in San Francisco with his leadership development company. He addresses topics at the intersection of self-awareness and team performance and a lot more. Since 1997, Jonathan has trained extensively in the discipline of mindfulness, and his work with leaders and teams emphasizes simple and practical ways to improve performance, efficiency, and workplace cultures by integrating mindfulness sensibilities. Jonathan, it's wonderful to have you here on our podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so excited about this because this is our first podcast in English. You might hear that. I'm a little nervous today. But yeah, this episode will be all about you, about your experiences with mindfulness. And the first question I would like to ask is, where does your mindfulness path begin?
Well, thank you for the question. My mindfulness practice really begins where I think a lot of people's mindfulness practice begins, and that's a recognition of my own suffering and having a hard time. So soon after I graduated from college or university, I just took an honest look in the mirror and I saw that, you know, if learning how to balance my checkbook and drive a car was all there was to life, I was going to have a very sad 80 years. And so in that recognition, I went looking. I became what sometimes people call a seeker. I started practicing things like mindfulness and yoga, and this was in the 90s, and really started looking for more skillful ways to go through this human experience. It's like going on a ride in a car. I wanted a less bumpy ride. I was getting a pretty bumpy ride and it wasn't satisfactory. And so started practicing things like meditation and yoga, started reaching out to communities that were doing the same. And right around that time or soon thereafter, I relocated from the Midwest. I grew up in Wisconsin. I moved out to the San Francisco area.
I'm intrigued. I mean, you were pretty young and you could already name it. You could say, I am suffering and I want to do something about it. I think that's pretty amazing because very often at a young age, we know that something might not be perfect, but we seek like happiness or more joy in life. How did you come to a stage where you could already say, hey, I'm suffering? What was it that led you to this recognition?
Really great follow-up. One of the things that came to me very early on is I grew up in a middle-class family, and I recognized, and I grew up in a small shipbuilding town where lots of people were working class, and I recognized that I had been afforded opportunities and privileges that others hadn't, and some of those others were my close friends. And so, you know, I went through a certain inquiry internally around what is a value of a human life, and does it mean money, or does it mean success, or what does it actually look like? And sort of in that, I was brought up against my own privilege, some of that socioeconomic. In retrospect, I wasn't identifying it as white privilege at that time, but some of it just being, you know, receiving white privilege in our culture. And so a lot of it was sort of this perfect storm, I would say. And I feel very fortunate that my tolerance for suffering is quite low. And so when something doesn't feel right, I want to address it immediately. And so that's part of what brought me to practices. I was disenfranchised with conventional culture to a certain extent.
But in a way, you notice that there is suffering in a certain place, and that got you to a lot of insight, and still you moved away, right? You moved to another place and you started your life path in a way also in another place. So that's pretty interesting. Is there a reason for that? Is there a reason why you landed in the San Francisco or in the Bay Area?
You know, I went to India around 2001. And I was, again, I was sort of in seeker mode. And I talked to a lot of the holy men in India. And I told them that I was thinking of moving to San Francisco. And they said, oh, the holiest place on earth. And I said, why do you say that? And they say, well, the most sacred place on earth isn't where people are the most religious. It's where the most innovative thought is happening. And of course, there's lots of wonderful innovative places in the world. But I'm sure they were supporting me because that was what I had already thrown out, the city that I had thrown out. I had a friend that lived in San Francisco, so that made the transition a little more easy. But I really recognized that I needed to be in a context where my developing practice and relationship to, you know, conscious awakening or mindfulness practice had the support. I just think community is so essential in, especially in those early stages. And so I knew where I needed to go. I did a basic analysis of various options throughout the United States. And the one that checked all the boxes was the Bay Area. So this is where I've been for the last 22 years or so.
Wow. What a courageous step after India, like going to the Bay Area and starting life in a way in San Francisco. I can really relate. I always say like my mindfulness and spiritual practice didn't really begin in San Francisco, but in a way they did. I mean, I was 8 when I read the Dalai Lama the first time, but here I suddenly understood what it means to read the Dalai Lama or to really deeply experience mindfulness and yoga practices. So in a way, my path really started in this area as well. When we initially talked, and I really liked that, we talked about being instead of doing and also finding a simple way to practice mindfulness. Simplicity is also the guiding word for today. And I wonder, what does it mean for you to find a simple way to practice? Or what does simplicity mean to you?
Mm-hmm. For me, simplicity is what's left over when you strip everything away. When you strip thought away and feeling away and doing away and you strip everything away, what's left over? Well, there's a simple ground of being. There's a simple luminous awareness that I think is available and that I've experienced. And so for me, simplicity is sort of that recognition that nothing needs to be done and nothing needs to be undone. That doesn't mean that we don't act in the face of, you know, social injustice and things like this. But it's sort of like the Quaker saying, only speak if you can improve upon the silence. That's a pretty tall order because silence is pretty wonderful. And so for me, that simplicity of being, that recognition, I was studying philosophy in the late 90s, sort of as an independent project. And that capacity, I studied a lot of existential thought, a lot of Eastern thought. And so that capacity to not stir things up too much. A lot of our difficulties come from stirring things up. So one of the last lines in my bio on my website is I'm interested in the relationship between seer, seeing, seen, and simplicity. All four of those come together, I think, in a really clear way when we're not muddying the waters. And the irony, of course, is mindfulness practice does stir up the waters a little bit. Intentionally, but it also settles them simultaneously. It's really got this sort of dual function. And so that's sort of a beginning. It's so simple to be who we are until we feel like we need to be someone else. And so there's a huge acceptance piece to that practice as well.
So much of what you said is just like working inside of me and I don't even know where to start. I said when I arrived here 2 days ago, my friends asked me, so how do you feel about coming back? And what is it that makes it so special for you to come back? And I said, you know, I arrived at the airport and I had this feeling to be seen again. So what you just said, like seeing to be seen and finding the simplicity in the practice really resonates with me. And I think that's something I'm trying to find a way to also relate it to what I experience at the moment in my work. I conducted a mindful leadership workshop, the last one on Monday, and I felt like people had really high expectations. They wanted everything. They wanted to understand mindfulness. They wanted to have powerful practices. They wanted to have tools in their daily work. And I said to them, you know, the first step is to simply show up. It isn't about the tools. It isn't about changing the culture right away. It's about simply showing up. It's about being present in a simple way. And at the end, the feedback was, oh, we're so disappointed. We had higher expectations. And I've been thinking about this. What's your thought on this? I don't even want to say more, but what's your thought on this? Like, how can we bring together the simplicity, the understanding of the simplicity, and still kind of work with people's expectations in a way?
Einstein said that any intelligent fool can make things more big or difficult or complex or more violent. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage to move in the other direction. And so I think that's our practice. Our practice is to normalize and psychoeducate around the value of this deeper current or this substrate of being that is available and actually is more effective than being clever. You know, when I went to study initially with one of my primary mindfulness influences, Jack Kornfield, in 2004 for the first time, the mind is really a nasty master. It convinced me and convinces many people that you got to do your penance to be worthy to sit in from somebody with that much experience. And of course, anyone who sat with Jack, the first experience is like, it's like going to your grandma's house. You're loved immediately. You had to do no preparation. You could have just shown up at any time in your life and you'd be welcome in any condition. And I think that when people realize that the mind isn't going to answer what we need as solutions, the mind is wonderful in sorting out the details and then, you know, closing the deal on the ideas that come from the heart or the body or from being. But it's not a very good originator. It just tries to be clever and the smartest one in the room. And that's usually not particularly useful, although it looks really nice and it's great for persona and if you want to be a superstar. But as we're seeing, superstars don't actually deliver in the long run. It's sort of flashy and then it's like a firework and it's gone. And if we want a light that's bright over time, we got to find a better source.
Yeah, I think you're so right. What you said about the mind, I often say make the mind your ally. But what I feel is that so many people have this deep yearning of like understanding the mind, understanding neuroscience, understanding every bit and piece of what mindfulness does, what mindfulness practice kind of helps you to achieve. And I think the overall practice is to untangle the mind in a way that you can just sit with it, rest with it, and be witness in a way. And then I often hear about this, I have to work on myself, I have to show up to do the work. And again, there's not only the cognition, but also the intention of I work hard in my professional life, and then I work hard in my private life. And at the end, I keep working and working all the time, which is kind of the contrary to being instead of doing, right? But I get it. I think there are many belief systems also kind of related with this, entangled with this. How do you deal with that? How do you help people understand that they don't have to work so hard?
Well, in a call we just had a couple of days ago inside the Mindful Professionals Network, which is a network my company hosts, I use the phrase, instead of trying hard, try easy. And of course, it's really hard to try easy because we've been so conditioned that doing our best is pushing, over efforting until we're exhausted. You know, if you've ever done a yoga pose, you struggle to get into the pose, and then at some point you're so exhausted you don't want to do it anymore, and then you drop into the actual pose. You were fighting with your own mind, and then the pose was waiting for you. And the same is true in projects. We push against a project, we push, and then we drop down exhausted, and we realize if we've done our work well, the project starts pulling us. We don't need to push. And so that's just one example, I think, of this important skill of self-acceptance rather than self-improvement, you know, receiving what is. And the irony is when we accept ourselves as we are with all our, you know, foibles and difficulties, then we start on an honest footing for development, which isn't improvement, it's change, it's growth, it's more organic. You know, the acorn isn't mad that it's not a tree. It's really good at being an acorn. It will be a tree when it's time to be a tree. And so the same is true with us, is to not be so impatient. And that's where being present is really useful, is we find that the present is satisfying when we're actually in it. It's only not satisfying when we're not in it.
Yeah, it's that simple, right? Yeah, that reminds me of a question I had on Monday. Now I understood it. So it's all about being present. But what is when my answer to myself, when I ask myself, am I present, is no. Then I said, then you got it. The moment you say no, that's when you're present. And they were like, huh. And I think that's something I find very challenging sometimes too. And you just said it so beautifully, like make people understand without making them understand that it has to click inside you in like falling into the pose. But then I look at the people I work with and probably the people you work with also within your community. You have leaders, you have people with a lot of pressure on themselves. They have a lot of responsibility, and sometimes it isn't easy, right, to not be in your mind, to not be very strategic, very cognitive, very expressive also about what you want to achieve and when you want to achieve it. So again, you're basically in the basic construction of the mind, looking back, analyzing the past in order to plan for the future. How do you make it graspable for people who are so in this mode? How do you help them find back to themselves? How do you help them find back to the simplicity?
Well, I think that's where awareness practice is really essential, because the word mindfulness literally translated means things remembered. And so remembering ourselves, remembering the present moment, and things that bring us to the present moment are often physical things, body-based cues, for instance, because the body is never in the future or the past. It's always in the present moment. And so it makes a really good anchor for bringing us back. And as awareness develops, as mindfulness grows, it's also spacious. And so one of the things that happens is we take ourselves too seriously. We take our jobs too seriously. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be serious about them and, you know, deliver on them, but we do over-identify with our roles. And so once there's more space, we realize that this in a greater context is not the end of the world. You know, if every day is a catastrophe, we're going to burn our fuse out. And so recognizing that that's not a very skillful way to live. And I think a lot of folks are awakening to that because of COVID, because sort of this indefinite on pause feeling, oh, so there has to be more meaning. There has to be more purpose. Where am I going to build this out? And in some ways, that was my own awakening in my early 20s, was it was a crisis of purpose. If the only goal was to live the American dream, that's a total nightmare. I wanted to live a real awakening. I didn't want to live a dream. I wanted to, you know, be awake to the greatest degree possible, make informed decisions, and live what I consider an inspired life. I wanted to be my own hero. And I think everybody should want to be their own hero.
Yeah, I totally agree. So did you feel like when you were 20, first of all, I realize I'm suffering. And then second, I realize I want to find a purpose in life. And then third, you notice, oh, I think the purpose of life is to be awake. Did you get there so quickly?
You know, I was really lucky to have a couple of early mentors that I didn't even know were mentors at the time. One was my ceramics professor in college, who gave me a book after I'd graduated, and I was not a particularly good undergraduate student. He gave me a book and said, read chapter 6 of this. And so I brought this book. I didn't read chapter 6. I just brought it with me, and it sat in my, you know, stuff for 6 months, and I read chapter 6. And it introduced me. The book was The Path of Least Resistance. I've never mentioned that publicly, but The Path of Least Resistance, I want to say by Robert Fritz or someone like that. And it was all about working with the structures of our life rather than the contents of our life. And that was a really useful book of, oh, if I really want to make adjustments, it's not about pruning all the leaves off the tree. It's about cutting down the tree at the root. And once I realized that, once I realized there was a deeper psychology at work in myself and in others, I get really fascinated with that. That's all, I mean, for the last 25 years, that's what I'm interested in, is how does mindfulness apply to self-liberation, like you were describing. When you notice that you're not mindful, that's being mindful. Awareness is self-liberating. When you shine a flashlight into a dark room, you don't have to do something extra. The room is lit up just from shining the light. And so when we cultivate that light, that inward knowing and awareness, or resting in the one who knows, a lot of our stuff gets cleaned up and resolved, and not instantly. It's not magic. It takes time because the old patterns are in place. And so it takes time to wear them down over time. Again, I've been practicing for a couple decades. And does that mean that I'm perfectly awakened? Most definitely not. I still have all my old personality traits. I'm a little more skillful in them. They're a little softer, but they're still there, the good ones and the bad ones. It's not about, you know, erasing the personality. It's about being skillful with the cards we've been dealt.
I like that, what you're saying. I like that you're pointing out that you don't really change as a person. And I think a lot of people want that. They want to, they think as they go on the mindfulness path, they will change as a person. But I think it's more about loving yourself as you are, showing up to meeting yourself in the best way possible, and also experiencing as you this space that you described, and also noticing that the space is always changing, shifting, evolving, getting bigger, sometimes smaller, and different colors and different experiences. But I would like to ask you, what is this space for you? Or maybe just looking at it right now, how do you experience this mindfulness space currently?
One thing that I think is really important is space doesn't mean distance. There's space between us right now. We're not in the same place doing this interview. And yet, I can only speak from my own experience, but I feel connected to you. I feel close to you in this moment. And so that spaciousness is shared. It actually is a coming together. Even though we're distant physically to a certain extent, I don't feel distant. You know, often we get talks about, oh, how do you create intimacy or connection over Zoom? Well, presence. It doesn't matter if one person's in India and one person's in San Francisco. If you're both present, you're held in that awareness, and that distance isn't experienced in the same way because you're connected. And so for me, that spaciousness, I mean, really awareness and spaciousness in some ways, you know, one of the things that I like to say is that awareness is not in the world. The world is in awareness. So, you know, often we're used to sort of thinking about things in terms of objects and, oh, this thing, awareness or this idea or whatever it is just another thing in the world. I would say, and my experience bears this out, that awareness is of a different order, is of a non-located order. And because of that, all things are held in awareness. So when I touch into awareness, it's inherently spacious and all enveloping. It's not always that beautiful. Like, that's a little more poetic than it is, you know, than it was this morning on the meditation cushion. But I think that's an important piece, is that, you know, it's a fundamental shift. And what that shift has done for me personally, let's say, is before I found practice and awareness, I felt like things were happening in the world, and then I was reacting or responding, if skillful, to them. One of the things that a practice gives us is it gives us a rudder. It gives us a sail to our sailboat, so we're not just in a bobber or in a buoy. It gives us a sail. So it flips cause and effect a little bit on its head and says, oh no, causes are internal, prime movers are internal, and the expression is external. And so for me, knowing that spaciousness and relating to it in awareness makes that shift possible in a way that's really edifying and really empowering. You know, I work with a lot of people that they feel like they're in helpless situations because they feel like the situation dictates the terms. And I've just found that once you're situated in awareness, that can no longer be true.
Yeah, you're kind of re-owning that space between stimulus and response, right? Simply put. And you notice that there is a space that you can create, that you can kind of take responsibility for and also shape in a way that feels right to you in the first place. But I don't want to go to that point. I want to go to something else that you just said, which I think is really important, is what is space? And you said space is something that evolves. I want to put it simply now because I want to get to that point where you said we can kind of meet in that space wherever we are. And I think a point that I want to make is we can meet with kindness. We can meet with empathy and love. And this is what we bring also to spaces like Zoom or digital meetings. And I think that's so, so important for people in leadership positions and people in general working from home or virtually. And that's a question I often get, like, how do we bring empathy into the digital space? It's just technology and, you know, it's all work related. How do we see each other as human beings? How can we be human with each other in a way? And you just touched upon that a little. Let's go deeper there. How can we do that? How can we touch that empathy inside of ourselves? What do you recommend? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think practice is really important, whether it's kindness towards ourselves or compassion towards ourselves, is really essential, because then we have touched that in ourselves and know how to share it with others. The other piece that mindfulness practice does is it opens us up to multiple perspectives and to a recognition that we don't know all the perspectives. And once we know that, we really, that's the birth of curiosity and sort of going in soft. When they asked Jane Goodall, how did you learn so much about the apes? Nobody else learned anything about those apes. And her answer was, we went in without guns. Because if we went in without guns, we had to go in careful because we were vulnerable. The moment you go in with guns, you don't have to worry if you surprise them or anything because you got a gun. But the moment you go in without that, you have to be sensitive to the other. So often the mind is used as a gun. It's combative often. And so when we go in with the heart, we go in vulnerable, we go in more careful because we're vulnerable too. But of course, that's very disarming. When somebody shares something vulnerable with us, we're more likely to share something vulnerable with them, whether it's content-based or it's energetic. If you see that somebody's soft and smiling or humble or sad, you're less on guard. And so I think a lot of that came through early COVID time, because you saw people stand up from their computer and they had sweatpants on and a dress shirt on and things like that. You get to see their humanity, and everybody was in those sorts of situations. Everybody was doing laundry between calls. Everybody was, you know, trying to turn on their kid's iPad for school between calls. That's always true. And when we let go of the facade, when we let go of, oh, everything's got to be perfect or it's not valued, then there's this opportunity that unfolds. And again, when we touch that in ourselves, it's obvious. Oh, my hip hurts when I'm sitting, and I've been sitting for 25 years. Like, oh, it still hurts. Like, then I'm a little less likely to be judgmental or sarcastic or nasty towards somebody else whose hip hurts. I know what it's like to have a hip that hurts. And again, that's just one example, but it's everything. Oh, they're having a hard day. I know what it's like to have a hard day. I'm not going to pretend I never have hard days. But we do that, right? Like, we're in the age of technology and social media and images, and everybody's posting only their perfect vacations and these sorts of things. None of those people's lives are perfect. In fact, some of them might be really difficult and much worse than yours. But yet we glorify it. We have to have this carrot. And so what practice does is it gets really real. Nothing can hide when we're sitting still. It's part of the reason why it's a little difficult to begin practice is because we deep down, we know that. We know if we're deceiving ourselves. Even if we're deceiving ourselves that we're deceiving ourselves, we know that. And when we sit down, there's just nowhere to hide. It's all true.
Yeah, it's a path, right? Mindfulness is a path of experiencing yourself. But as you said, it's also a path of meeting with others, honestly, truthfully, eye to eye, and again, every single moment. I always include one practice in whatever workshop I give, and that is attentive and mindful listening and attentive and mindfully showing up with each other. And I always say it doesn't matter if we do that in presence or if we do it virtually, it always works. And afterwards, when I split up the groups and the people come back, I always say, now for a moment, just let's rest and look at each other and see that glow. See the glow you see in each other when you're seen, you know, just going back to the part of being seen. Just look at how good it feels to show up with all your vulnerabilities, with all your truths, and have someone who is only listening to you and then only repeating what you're saying without any evaluation or anything. And I love that part. That's for me one of the best parts of my work sometimes, to show people that we can kind of glow with each other. Everyone for themselves, but we can glow with each other as we are. And there is nothing to assess or nothing to evaluate. And I think that's a practice we can have every single moment in our work, that kind of throws us back to ourselves, but it makes us meet with each other. When I look at our conversation now, I find a lot of beauty in it. I find a lot of simplicity and lightness in it. I enjoy the flow we were having. But I also think about the different audiences we're talking to today. We're talking to an audience that is based in Germany or based in Europe. And hopefully we're also talking to a wider audience that is spread out into the world. And something that I have mentioned when we talked before is intercultural differences in mindfulness. I don't even know if I want to call it that, but I really feel that there are different kind of access points to mindfulness, depending on where you're based. What's your thought on this? What have you made any observation in this direction?
Well, I think ultimately each individual has different propensities and learns in different ways and applies in different ways. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about mindfulness. It's like water pours into any vessel. It doesn't care about the shape. It just pours because it's that flexible and that adaptable. And I think that each person has to find their own mindfulness practice. Some, it might be more body-based and movement-based. For some, it might be formal sitting practice. For others, it might be different things. And so some of those might have cultural sort of tendencies or propensities across the board. But I think it's up to, it's really an individual thing then that gets integrated collectively. When we've done work in organizations in other countries, you know, it's about the sensitivities of those cultural norms and really getting into the details and finding out. We've done work with women leaders in different countries. And so that's a very different thing depending on what the country is. But that's just one example, but it's across the board. It's about being a good listener and finding out what is truly useful. I mean, one of the things Mindful Life, Mindful Work really, is proud of is making the learnings. And it's not always mindfulness proper. In fact, it usually isn't. It's more mindful approaches, but making those practices accessible and applicable. Because if anyone feels shamed or feels like they're not ready, it's been presented in a way that was was unskillful in some way. It should be really accessible, because, you know, I like to say, when I started practicing mindfulness, for the first 3 years, I pretended to practice. And everybody starts where they start. You know, you sit on the cushion and somebody said it was good for you and you don't really know why. And you're sitting there and, you know, I must have had some early benefits to be able to pretend for 3 whole years. But you know, we all start where we start, and to give a lot of space and acceptance, because we were all brand new at something and we were all brand new at one time to this thing. And so, you know, I think that's really important. And the same is true. Like I always like to start really slowly with company engagements. You know, we don't want to sell something big. We want to sell something small and build a relationship, and then see if it can grow into something big. And if it's not meant to, that's good to know too, because we want success and we want to be helpful. We don't want to just make money.
Mm, you create value in another way.
Mm, in many ways, hopefully.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I also like that you just pointed out, it's really, especially when you work with companies and organizations, it's about building mindful relationships at the beginning, right? To see in which way or in which direction you can take it together with the company. I think that's a really important point that I have found, that it's always a co-creative process and you can't do it by yourself when you make an offer of mindfulness, because there always needs to be a certain kind of ground to receive what you have to offer in the way that you can offer it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you want it to be that dialogue. Otherwise, it's just a one-way conversation of sharing information, and it doesn't get to that sort of deeper application for sure.
Jonathan, we've talked about so much already. We've talked about your starting point to mindfulness, the recognition of suffering, I already said. What a beauty that you noticed that so early. We talked about your path of mindfulness, how you experience it, how the experience changed, and how you also kind of developed your practices, how you shared it with leaders, with people in organizations and in companies, how you established your network. You said so many great things, like mindfulness, yes, has to be simple. It has to have a simple starting point, but it can take you to spaces, deep experiences, not always pretty, but certainly always valuable. We've talked about empathy and experiencing empathy in all kinds of spaces. You just said mindfulness needs to be accessible and in a way, again, simple to apply, maybe even. And at the end, you said something really important, that by kind of selling mindfulness, we still have to pursue a mindful path and establish mindful relationships in order to take it further. I'd like to continue our conversation, I really do, but at the same time, I look at the time and I think we've given our listeners a lot to think about, a lot to digest. But still, I would like to ask you, do you have one final thought that you would like to share today?
It's more important to practice a little bit regularly than a lot once in a while. It's so important. It's like brushing your teeth or eating healthy. We need to do it over time. You know, if anyone asked me today, hey, are you going to meditate for another 25 years? It would be overwhelming for me, and I'd probably get exhausted even thinking about it. But can I do a little bit today? Yeah, the time will take care of itself. The growth and development in some ways takes care of itself. Our job is just to practice. In addition to simplicity, the word practice has really been a guiding force in my life. So, you know, do little practices today.
And then maybe again tomorrow, which is today when you sit. Thank you so much. That's great. Yeah, dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I certainly did. I really enjoyed this conversation. And you will find all the links and info about Jonathan and Mindful Life, Mindful Work in our show notes. If you liked our episode today, please do not forget to subscribe either on Spotify or iTunes. And also feel free to leave a comment with your thoughts or questions. We make sure to reply. I thank you all for your support today. As I said, that was my first episode in English. I was a little bit nervous, but I think we both did well. I had great support with Jonathan. Jonathan, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was wonderful. I'm glad we didn't do it in German.
Maybe we try it next time. Thank you so much. And yeah, thanks for sharing your presence. Thanks for sharing your wisdom. I think it was very, very valuable for many, many people. It was certainly very valuable for me. And I'm already looking forward to our next episode. To everyone, stay healthy, stay tuned, but above all, live mindfulness in a simple way by just showing up with yourself in a loving and kind way every single day and let the practice unfold. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Bye.